just a visual reference, right? To, oh, sorry.
Just a visual reference to the person I'll be speaking about. He'll come up kind of at the end. I wanted to thank Alessia and Susanna for the invitation to speak here, and to say how, just quickly, very briefly, how this came about. So we were asked to speak, but we weren't quite really sure what was going to happen. So I got a paper from Peter, which he, a different version of the paper you just read. So, you know, it was like, well, all right, so here's the thing on archaeology and Benjamin, right? There's got to be some form of, you know, connecting this. So I immediately started thinking about archaeology and its relationships to a particular history. That's not exactly what I'm about to, like, bring up today, right? But there is something I think that's, there is a little piece on archaeology in here, but there is something I think which is really significant, which is for Mariátegui, there was also this sort of issue of having to deal with the coexistence of a past and a present in his actual moment. This is extremely common within kind of Latin American intellectual thought in the last, you know, 200 years. And for Mariátegui, the problem was, well, how do we figure that, how do we figure out how to make a sort of revolutionary change in society, right, through that coexistence, given that it's already there, right? So the sorts of things that I'll be addressing today have that at their base. And I'm going to focus a little bit on Mariátegui himself as a figure and the origins of his thought, which have to do with that context I've just mentioned. So my purpose in the brief time I have today is to consider the origins of the acute heterogeneity of critical thought in the early 20th century Andes, particularly in the vigorous form that it took after the mid-1920s. From the intense production across the period, one could focus on any number of actors in different corners of the region. For example, the intellectuals who self-identified as the Grupo de Guayaquil in Ecuador and, inspired by the aesthetic of social realism, elaborated a sort of tropical version that would see fruition in novels like Demetrio Aguilera Malta's Don Goyo from 1933, which is a precursor to magical realism, right? Or in Bolivia, around the anarcho-syndicalist ferment that emerged out of the defense of indigenous miners' rights and led to the critique of extractivism by figures like Tristan Maroff and also indigenous leaders like Luis Cusicanqui. The case of Peru is at least equally rich, and as in the previous examples, one could speak of a variety of geopolitical sites at which the need to approach critically the historical spatial juncture, which you could kind of loosely describe as post-colonialism and imperial capitalism, right, at that moment, of the moment arose. Perhaps no intellectual better exemplifies that amalgamation of different histories and actors than José Carlos Mariátegui, widely referred to as the first Marxist thinker in Latin America. It's difficult to overstate what a towering figure Mariátegui is in Latin American critical thought, right? A series of displacements, not only his own, fomented the heterogeneity of Mariátegui's critical thought. In the existing scholarship on his life and work, a pronounced and perhaps not unwarranted focus has been placed on Mariátegui's formation in Europe. Before his 1919 voyage, he was widely considered to be a dandy with an interest in mysticism and contemporary society. While Mariátegui seems to have had the wherewithal to grapple with political and social issues related to the authoritarian government that Peru found itself under before his departure in 1919, it was only after his return in 1923 that he would pronounce that, and I quote, my quotes are in Spanish, but you can read it in English up there. El itinerario de Europa había sido para nosotros el mayor y más tremendo descubrimiento de América. Descubrimos al final, sobre todo, nuestra propia tragedia, la del Perú, la de Hispanoamérica. Mariátegui himself related that change in his perspective to his experience in two countries in Europe that left an outsized impression on him, Italy and Germany. In the first, he came into contact with activists and intellectuals such as Piero Gobetti and Antonio Gramsci, and read Marx in Italian translation. In the second, and primarily in Berlin, he witnessed radical political organizing and immersed himself in the most recent aesthetic interventions, like those of Weil, Klee, Kandinsky, and Grosch. His apartment on Potsdamer Strasse was often visited by figures like Herbert Walden and many others, right? He left Germany in February 1923 with the certainty, which he held until his death in 1930, that after the Soviet Union, it would be the second socialist state in Europe. This brief description of Mariátegui's European exile intimates, I think, a fairly standard way of understanding the supporting structures, as it were, for the development of his critical thought on Andean society. and applies to any number of Latin American intellectuals in the last long century. What would Rubén Darío be without Paris, or José Martí without New York? In this sense, the encounter with the North becomes a sort of geopolitical lens through which Latin American intellectuals see their world anew, and in Mariátegui especially represents an awakening to Peru's place in the world system. I'd like to consider two other factors that I believe are related in originating Mariátegui's later critical thought. The first is archaeology. The impact that archaeological discourse, and in particular the vigor of this prestigious science, had on Mariátegui is well documented. There are many figures, but none stands out as much as Julio C. Tello. The archaeologist of indigenous descent must have cut a striking figure in the 1920s, both due to his brilliant synthetic theories of indigenous societies and to the fact that he declared his indigenous ancestry rather than obfuscated. At the time, this was highly unusual for an intellectual. His principal work, Introducción a la Historia Antigua del Perú, Introduction to the Ancient History of Peru, from 1921, proposed the monogenetic thesis, which would be Tello's major contribution to archaeological theory. In brief, the theory argues that Chavín culture, 900 to 200 BC, that the Chavín culture of northern Peru originated all indigenous culture in Peru. There's these sorts of parallels, right? And that it was not until the Inca Empire flourished right before the conquest in the 16th century that this diversity could once again be contained by a nation. Right? I'll tell you why it's in comillas, in scare quotes, in a minute. Perhaps most importantly for our discussion of Mariátegui and what he may have gleaned from such texts is the idea proposed by Tello that Hispanic culture represented not simply an interruption or dispersion of the coherence of indigenous society, but also an attempt to exclude the indigenous culture from the national in the pre-modern sense that Tello gave that term. In this way, Mariátegui's reading of archaeology took seriously proposals concerning the absorptive plastic nature of indigenous cultures, which I believe clearly shaped the ways in which Mariátegui theorized the indigenous as a stand-in proletariat in his principal work, Seven Interpretive Essays on Peruvian Reality from 1928. But Mariátegui's being steeped in the archaeological, critical, and artistic traditions of his time seem only part of how he developed his critique of colonialism and its after effects. Recently, I've begun to look at a series of texts that have hardly mattered in the study of Mariátegui, which to me is shocking, precisely because they represent his daily interactions after 1923 with activists and indigenous peoples, often activist indios, or indigenous peoples, right, as they were called. Upon his return to Peru and in Lima, Mariátegui immediately set about an intense agenda of intellectual work accompanied by collaboration with local organizers. He held weekly meetings and often daily meetings at his home on the outskirts of Lima's colonial downtown, and it was there that he received indigenous activists who had recently migrated or arrived in Lima in order to petition the state for protection of their rights for any number of different reasons. Here there's an important context that has to do with the fact that what international capitalism produces in the space of the Andes is actually an intensifying of feudalism, and that has an impact on these indigenous figures, right? So they all show up at his house. One of these activists, Mariano Larico Yujra, recounted his life and conversations in the 1980s, which were then transcribed into a book entitled Yo Fui Canillita de José Carlos Mariátegui, Autobiografía de Mariano Larico Yujra. Canillita is a very peculiar term. I was the newspaper boy for José Carlos Mariátegui. The intricacies of how knowledge circulated in the relationships between indios and intellectuals and how it was shaped by these contacts is visible in this testimony. Due to the interview format in which it is told, Larico Yujra's biography is especially illuminating with respect to the intercommunication. Right? Larico Yujra was an Aymara Indian who was born in the southern department of Puno in 1909. Shortly after, a frustrated rebellion in his home province of Huancané and the massacre of indigenous peoples that it led to in 1923, he traveled to Lima in order to find security as well as educational possibilities. Right? It is in this context that he recounts Mariátegui's engagement in another sort of reading. In many cases, in most, Lima's urban intellectuals had little firsthand experience of the living and working conditions of highland indigenous peoples, let alone their culture. Indeed, many of these intellectuals had never traveled to the Sierra. In this way, the indigenous peoples that they came into contact with in Lima substituted for that experience and became literally the bodies on which colonialism and the punitive post-colonialism of the region could be read. Lerico Yuja recounts that a fellow indigenous person, Mariano Pajo, provided evidence to Mariátegui precisely through the sight of his body. Quote, Mariano Pajo le había contado a Mariátegui todo lo que pasó en la sublevación de Huancané en 1923. Carlos Condonera, another activist, lo llevó donde Mariátegui. Mariano Pajo se había bajado el pantalón y le habló mostrando todas sus cicatrices, sus piernas, su espalda, sus brazos. Todas las cicatrices le había visto Mariátegui a Mariano Pajo. Right? So there's this incredible scene where there's these indigenous people kind of taking off their clothes in front of them, right? The operative dynamic communicated by the scene is a well-known one, insofar as it insists on the physicality of the Indian and on the examination through vision on the part of the intellectual. The analog for the encounter is the medical examination. In this particular case, there is also a ready prescription for the ailment. Quote, Mariátegui le había dicho, ahora tienes que seguir luchando por tu raza. Ahora los campesinos tienen que unirse con los obreros, con los intelectuales, con los mistis, que tienen ideas progresistas. Ahora ya tenemos que estar juntos todos. Solo si estamos en un solo puño, todos los que somos explotados, obreros, campesinos, choferes, hombres, niños, mujeres, si estamos todos juntos, podremos salvarnos. Este es un trabajo que tienen que hacer ustedes. Ustedes tienen que hablar en quechua, en aymara. Tienen que prepararse para hacer una revolución. Right? Oh, sorry. I'm studying for the translation. The tutelary relationship between intellectuals and subalterns is pronounced here because, of course, it is the acquisition of a political education that sits at the core of such texts. But I would caution against reading this scene and others in a way that identifies only tutelage in it and thus tends towards a black and white image of the powerful intellectual and the powerless indio, or worse, the intellectual who fills the indio with his knowledge. Indoctrination is not the result. While Lariko Yuja's testimony here stresses the communication of political goals and strategies that emanate from a Marxist reading of colonialism, it does not demonstrate how that communication was received. The transmission of knowledge is complicated and often productively tergiversated. And I would argue that this dynamic is at the core of the formation of Mariátegui's critical thought. Let me finish with one more example that picks up on this lesson and how it may have been read at a much later point. The historian César Levano recounts that in 1972, the already indigenous leader, Saturnino Wilca, a Quechua monolingual who could neither read nor write, left his home province of Cusco for the first time in order to meet with Peru's leftist military leader on the topic of agrarian reform. During his reception in the presidential palace, Wilca noticed a photographic portrait of José Carlos Mariátegui on the wall. He immediately exclaimed, "Caisapi," which in Quechua means, "Here is the root." What does it mean for Wilca to have understood the figure of Mariátegui as the origin of the agrarian reform, and presumably too of his own praxis, without having any other access to the latter's written work? Remember, he was a Quechua monolingual who had never left Cusco. Right? In the 40 years that had elapsed since Mariátegui's death in 1930, what had his image and his critical thought become for indigenous people like Wilca? These are questions for future scholarship and scholars. And I want to stress that while these sort of considerations rest on the historical work that recuperates the sort of pronunciations I've discussed here, it is perhaps more urgent that from literary studies we theorize a transformation of critical thought in orality, not just in the Andes, but across Latin America. Thank you.